Italian-American, knows the power of maternal guilt. She knows that all Italian-Americans respond to it. In reality, she would have had to say much less than she did in this fictional dramatization for me to have never thought of pursuing stand-up comedy again. If she'd looked me in the eye a certain way and held that stare long enough, that would have ended my ambitions forever. Words would not have been necessary. I would keep working at the port and never challenge her decision. Something else would happen, though. That night, a darkness would start gathering around me. At first, it would just be a storm on the horizon, off in the distance. It would grow more ominous over time, moving closer as the years went by, until it was tailing me every waking hour. When that tsunami of depression finally overtook me, I would not have survived. Since my mother knows me better than anyone in this world, maybe she saw that future and decided that putting all her money on Artie to place was better than watching her son run a race he couldn't win. But let's say she played it safe, and I missed the train. I'm 50 years old, so by now I would have been working as a longshoreman at the Port of Newark for 30 years. If I hadn't gotten myself killed or arrested, I'd be making really good money by now. I'd be happy that my mother was well taken care of and enjoying a nice life, but I'd be tortured by my unfulfilled dreams. The way I've usually chosen to offset frustration in my life is by creating chaos in order to distract me from my own unhappiness. If I was still a longshoreman at 50, there is no doubt that my life would be complete chaos, because it was already in motion when I left. I'd been given a plum, lifelong job that required very little of me to keep it, so what did I do? I got embroiled in a few of the small handful of things that would have gotten me fired, if not worse. The International Longshoremen's Association is defined by connections and family ties. You don't get a job by strolling in, dropping off your resume, detailing your experience as a barista, and explaining to the head of HR that you're looking for a new challenge. You need to know a guy, or a guy who knows a guy. My friend's father, who we will call Mr. DiStefano, vouched for me. He even got me hired at a better wage than an average first-year union Joe. He was a major player in the union, and he looked after me, even telling people that I was a second cousin. That went a very long way, as you'll soon see. He was supportive and kind, but he wasn't Mother Teresa. The guy was very unapproachable and very intimidating. To become powerful in a union like that, you cannot be a cupcake, so basically every millennial in America would find his management style unacceptable. When I was around him, I was never sure if he liked me or wanted to break my arm. Before my first day, I met him in his office, and he told me that he would watch out for me and that if I got into any trouble, I should let people know that he was the one who got me the job. This was huge because he was basically granting me protection, the way a mafia godfather did to those who needed it in the neighborhood. "What kind of trouble do you mean, Mr. DiStefano?" I asked. "Gambling, stealing, importing drugs. People will try to drag you into it. Anyone tries to do that with you, let me know. I don't care what you do when you're not on the job. You can sell drugs, steal cars, I don't give a fuck what you do. But you get involved with anything down here, we've got beef. You understand?" "Yes, I do." By the way, if you don't know anything about the Longshoremen, do yourself a favor and watch On the Waterfront, starring Marlon Brando, one of the greatest films of the 20th century. Once you've seen it, you'll understand a lot about this period of my life. Mr. DiStefano was head of the International Longshoremen's Association, which was a huge achievement because he wasn't of Italian or Irish descent. No one other than Italians or Irishmen had held the position for decades, but he worked his way through the stranglehold the two ethnic groups had on those coveted union positions and got himself elected. He's a tough motherfucker who could both lead a mob of workers and play the political game. He's also currently under house arrest, by the way, but for the record, I never saw him do anything illegal. Hey, if you think our presidential elections are rigged, especially this last one, you haven't seen shit. When you're in the union, the head of your crew tells you who to vote for on election day, literally standing over you as you do it. I admire that. To me, it's a more honest method of being crooked. Anyway, everyone at the pier where I started working knew who I was with, and I couldn't have been more set up. That's how they talk about connections down there. They talk about who you're with. I was new, with no family members already working there like most guys, but I had some juice. And the perks of the job were not to be believed. We broke for lunch at noon, and weren't expected back until 1:30. Now that's a union. With an hour and a half to dine, we'd go to Downneck, which is also known as the Ironbound section of Newark, and we'd feast like kings. There is a diversity of incredible restaurants there serving the ethnic groups that have established themselves in Jersey over the years. There is Portuguese, Spanish, and Italian food, and places that combine all three into a style you won't find anywhere else. You can get paella, zuppa de pesce, cuts of steak, cooked all different ways. You can find whatever you want. There's a place called Tony de Caneca that I love, and the Spanish Tavern, which has the most amazing bread. One of my favorites was a Cuban place run by a guy who claimed that Tupac Shakur was alive and well and living in Cuba. He was very convincing, claiming that he'd shared a cigar with him and been to a party at his house. This made no sense at all because Tupac hadn't been murdered yet. There is an ice cream place called Nasto's that we go to afterward, which was like this Willy Wonka factory in the middle of all these great restaurants. Except it was Newark, so Willy Wonka would have had to be more like a wise guy. In his factories, the schnozberries don't taste like schnozberries. They taste like gabagool. The movie based on him wouldn't be Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. It would be Uncle Frankie and the Gabagool Factory. Because in Uncle Frankie's factory, you fat fucks, everything tastes like gabagool. In his factory, the Oompa Loompas aren't orange. They're red, white, and green. See how much fun writing books can be. Hemingway didn't have this much fun writing A Movable Feast. So, for a year and a half, I worked on the orange juice pier, unloading gallons of orange juice with a bunch of guys I got to know pretty well. The one thing that brought us all together, no matter how different we were, was that we would get a bonus at the end of the year based on how many ships we unloaded. It was an incentive to work as a team, and we did that really well. We made the bonus that year, and each walked away with a few thousand dollars, which I gave to my mom. Then they changed our crew and broke up the winning team. I got reassigned to another pier, which also unloaded orange juice. This one, however, was owned by a different guy who took a very different approach to labor policy. The day I started was the day the owner decided to break the union by hiring a bunch of South Americans willing to work 15 hours a day for $9 an hour. I couldn't blame him, because the guys in our crew were getting $40 an hour and spent most of the day playing 500 rummy on the job. The scabs he hired were Portuguese-speaking South Americans that he bussed in on former prison buses with bars over the windows. Good thing he did, because the longshoremen tried to kill them every single day the strike lasted. I refer again to On the Waterfront when I say that longshoremen don't strike. They riot. There's no peaceful picket lines or organized demonstration. There's violence and shouting. The cops usually let it run its course, because many of their brothers and fathers are longshoremen. When those poor scabs showed up, they were greeted with rocks, bottles, and Molotov cocktails on the way in and on the way out, every single day. Welcome to the port, scabs! As a longshoreman assigned to that pier, I was expected to join in and try to beat the shit out of any scab I got my hands on. As much as I was all for the union, I didn't want any part of it. I didn't want to kill some poor guy who probably sent his $9 an hour back home to his family in South America. The whole thing was brutal. I saw a guy tear his own brother out of a truck and beat him with a lead pipe because he was driving some scabs to work. So I skated by doing the minimum every day. I'd show up and yell a lot and move around in the crowd, but really spent most of my time on the outskirts of the fight with a six-pack. To fit in, occasionally I'd throw an empty Bud Longneck at a bus. This was the same week that I told my mother I wanted to try comedy again, and the end of my time in the union. But if I'd missed my train and she told me to keep working, I wouldn't have left. I would have stayed striking until it was settled and we went back to work. And at my new job, I would have already fucked up my future because, despite the strict warning from my mentor, before lunch, on my first day at the new pier, I'd already gotten into trouble. Some guy introduced himself and pulled me aside. Hey, take this bag to this Cuban deli in Elizabeth. You know where that is? Yeah, I said. But why should I do that? Just take the bag. If everything is in order, the guy will give you 100. And when you come back, I'll give you another 100. So I deliver a bag and get 200 bucks? Yeah, that's right, he said. It's easy. He gives you a C-note, I give you a C-note. And you make 200 bucks at lunch. I knew this was exactly what Mr. DiStefano had warned me about, but you see, I'd already broken his code during my time at the other pier. Betting on sports is a big thing down there, and since it's something I really enjoyed, I'd gotten into it pretty heavily. During a busy week with a lot of traffic, I'd make about $1,200, which was plenty, unless you owed money to a Shylock. You never wanted to borrow money from a Shylock, because the interest is worse than those credit cards they use to lure unsuspecting college freshmen into a lifetime of debt. But I had to do it because I'd lost a few big bets with a bookie, and the guy had to be paid if I wanted to keep my legs. I borrowed enough money from the Shylock to pay off the bookie, and I had my job and a steady paycheck, so, in time, both he and I knew that I'd be able to pay him off. At a huge loss, of course. The amount wasn't enough to put me under, so I was all right, and I felt even better about the situation because I had left that pier. It felt like the temptation was gone, and I'd gotten a new start. Until I decided to become a bagman before lunch on my very first day. A bagman is the courier who carries money between a bookie and the guys that place their bets with him week in and week out. It is a highly illegal occupation. I drove to Elizabeth that day, followed the owner of the Cuban deli into a back room, gave him the bag, and saw that it was full of cash. It was full of exactly 18 grand, which I know because he counted it in front of me. At the time, I'd never seen that much money in one place. Most of it crisp, clean $100 bills. Good, he said, and nodded at me. All here. He peeled off one of those new hundreds and handed it to me. I drove back, returned the empty bag, and was told by the first guy that the Cuban guy had called and that everything was in order. He handed me my second 100. So tomorrow, the guy said, we do the same thing. You mind doing this every day? A different deli? You'll know the route in no time. Correct me if I'm wrong, but does anyone know any happily retired bagmen? As far as I know, every bagman ends up dead or in jail. That was my future because this guy thought he had me hooked. Actually, he did have me hooked because he had something on me, which put me in his pocket for good. Compared to my father and some of the kids I grew up with, I don't have very many street smarts. But even I knew that this was a fucked up situation. Listen, I said to the guy, can I ask you a question? Yeah, go ahead. What would happen if all 18 grand wasn't there? Let's say I drive over tomorrow and there happens to be 17 grand. I'm not saying how that might happen, but let's say it does. Who gets blamed for that? Me or you? What do you think? He said. What do I think? I think I take the blame and I think you're an asshole. I ain't risking that every day, not for 200 bucks, not for anything. What's wrong with you? He said. Don't be so uptight. Today went fine. Yeah, sure it did. Today was fine, but that's the bait. There's a lot that can go wrong here, and I'll be the one taking the hit when it does. Nah, come on. All the guys that work here are honest guys, he said. They'd never do that to me or you. Come on, don't be a jerk-off. Then he stared at me for a second. Who you with, anyway? I told him the name. Bullshit, he said. No way. Check it out. I'm not lying to you. I'll see you later. The next morning, before breakfast, the guy found me and started enthusiastically kissing my ass. Hey, I have to apologize, he said. I'll never ask you to run a bag for me again. I had no idea. Please, tell Mr. DiStefano that I'd never do that to someone in his family. I made a big mistake. I found out later that Mr. DiStefano also hated the guy running bags, so he sent a stronger message than usual that I was protected. I was never fucked with again, but if I wasn't with Mr. DiStefano, I would have been fucked. That day I learned that I was surrounded by dangerous people. If they tried to turn me out as a bagman on my very first day, what the hell would they do by the end of the week? These guys were dirtier than my last crew. They were everyday bagmen, which means they were involved in a real racket that probably extended beyond betting. God knows what the owners of those delis were moving, because there was no end to the illegal activities at the port. The DEA regularly seized boxes that were welded onto the bottom of boats, full of kilos of blow. Merchandise from cars to electronics routinely disappeared, because if it was shady, it was going down at the port. What I did that one day could have meant 10 years behind bars. There was 18 grand in that bag, and if you're moving anything over 10, you're in real trouble. I also went from county to county with it within the state, which carries more penalties. But because my friend's father got me the job and vouched for me, I was in the clear. Instead, I got a grade-A apology. And later that week, after my mother gave me the vote of confidence, I took 2 days to get up the courage to tell Mr. DiStefano that I was leaving. I was terrified that he would take my decision personally, but he didn't. He asked me to stay on another week so he could find a replacement, and that was that. "Good luck, Art," he said. "Do your best. If it doesn't work out, I'll see you back here in 6 months. I'll have a job for you." "I can't thank you enough for that. I hope I won't need it," I said. "Listen to me," he said, staring me down across his desk. "What your mother went through with your father and not being able to get any money back from the insurance, all of that was horrible. She almost died taking care of him while raising you and your sister. Your family was on welfare. That was hard for you. Your mother still has a big mortgage on the house. You've got a job for 70 grand right now, which you won't have if you leave. I have to ask you, why do you want to struggle again? It's just something I have to do." He kept staring at me for what seemed like an eternity. Sitting there in his office, my plan didn't make much sense to me either. "Well, okay, Artie." The guys in my former crew didn't help matters much. They thought I was the biggest idiot they'd ever met. "You think you're gonna make it in show business? So you're gonna act like what, an idiot?" Their jokes would be followed by at least 3 minutes of laughter. They weren't wrong, because what were the odds? I tried not to doubt myself, but it wasn't easy, and I felt like a selfish prick, but I knew I had to do it. It's hard to explain how I knew it was right, but it was like a voice inside telling me to. Outwardly, I felt like I was spitting in my mother's face, because things had gotten back to normal, and I was turning it all upside down again. But I went for it, because I had to. My sister, on the other hand, had found her way into a stable life, because she'd left the house earlier than I had, even though she felt guilty about doing so. She was not there the morning my father died, and that bothered her for a long time, even though she was very close by, in Hoboken. I needed to live at home and help my mother because I was the fuck-up who didn't go to college. My sister was never that, and she should never feel guilty about having her shit together. Staying home and helping however I could was my only way of giving back. My dad did have one worry about my sister, but I was able to handle that situation for him. This is the exact conversation my sister Stacy and I had when it seemed to me that she and her boyfriend were getting serious. "Stacy, you've got to leave that guy. You can't marry him," I said. "Why would you say that? What's wrong with him?" "He sells cocaine, and you shouldn't be with a guy who sells cocaine." "You don't know what you're talking about," she said. "How do you know he sells cocaine?" "Because I bought cocaine from him." "Fuck you, Artie." She punched me in the face, stormed out of the room, and was upset with me for quite a while. But in the end, she didn't marry him, so Mission accomplished, Dad. I must take a moment to salute my sister for her strength and what she made of herself during the hardest time our family has ever known. Our father became a quadriplegic between her junior and senior years of high school, which is supposed to be the best time of your life. Stacy still got straight A's and was accepted to Rutgers University. We had no money, but she got in and she went. She hated it, though, and didn't want to be there. She wanted to be in the city and go to more of a tech school, so she applied to FIT, got in, and paid her way by bartending the entire time. She is so much stronger than I'll ever be. She didn't need drugs or drinking to cope. She threw herself into achievement. She incurred student loans and has paid them all off herself. Right out of college, she got a job with Phillips Van Heusen. Then, after just 6 months, got a job at Polo designing for Ralph Lauren. Then, she jumped to Abercrombie & Fitch, then back to Polo because they begged her to return. 2 years later, American Eagle offered her a big move. She wrote a ticket and got all she wanted and was there for 14 years, heading up the entire men's design department. One day, not too long ago, I said to my ma, "You know, you should feel good. I know you think you did something wrong raising us, because I know I've been a handful, but you didn't. Because we've both made something of ourselves." At the time, we were watching the Howard Stern show on the E! Channel. "Mom, look, you should be proud of this." There I was, co-hosting next to Howard, who happened to be wearing a shirt that my sister had designed. I said, "Clearly you did something right. My sister and I have seen the world thanks to our jobs. She's been all over Europe and Asia, and I went to Afghanistan to entertain the troops. Our mom should be nothing but proud. She should be prouder of Stacy, of course, because she's a strong, respectable person in every way. Let's face it, aside from my job, I'm a complete loser." Chapter 4 Sliding Doors, Part 2 Excuse the pun, but I got a little derailed there, so allow me to continue with what would have happened if I'd missed that train. My mentor got me out of trouble that time, but I'd put good money on me diving headfirst into being a bagman. I think I would have used his influence for exactly what he didn't intend me to use it for, to get into, not out of trouble. I would have gone back to the guy who recruited me to be a bagman and told him that I wanted in and that he'd better never fuck me over. I would have used Mr. DeStefano as my insurance policy instead of my get-out-of-jail-free card, because what could be more of a gamble than that? I would have convinced myself that I needed that side gig because I had a Shylock to pay off. But running bags wouldn't have really been about paying off my debt. It would have been about increasing the danger in my life. Running bags would have been exciting. Life must be thrilling for me to want to live it. And when it's not, I find a way to make it so. It's too bad that I don't enjoy the rush of exciting legal activities like bungee jumping, because I chase the same adrenaline high. The difference is that I get mine by doing what I'm not supposed to do instead of jumping off a bridge with a giant rubber band tied to my leg. Gambling is my skydiving. And let me tell you, when you gamble with money you don't have, the free fall lasts forever. Anyway, that's how it would go. I'd do everything I wasn't supposed to at work, and it would all have gotten worse as time went on. With each passing year, I'd see the inevitable path of my life as a longshoreman, so I'd need to find a way to kick it up a notch. Eventually, it would all blow up in my face, and I'd either have beef with Mr. DeStefano or be roughed up by a bookie, a Shylock, or a co-worker, maybe all three. Being involved in a gambling ring, I would have exposed my mother and sister to a world where they could be physically and financially hurt because of my actions. I wouldn't have my dream, but I'd have more chaos than I knew what to do with. Eventually, I'd be fired from the union and unable to work at the port after making an enemy of Mr. DeStefano. Instead of sitting here talking about this alternate universe years later, within a year, I would have been incarcerated. In this version of my life, jail is unavoidable. So I do my time, and I get out. Or I never get out. When coming up with probable scenarios, it's best to look at similar case studies. So here's one. I had a buddy in high school who did a crime, got caught, and went to Rahway State Prison, which is where I would have ended up if I'd gotten caught running bags in New Jersey. This kid, not much of a brain surgeon, robbed a gas station with a water pistol and went to jail when we were in our early 20s. Let's use his life as an indication of what would have been in store for me in prison. He got raped by a guy in the shower, got AIDS because of it, and died behind bars. That's what happened to my buddy from biology class. And I can't think of a darker way to go. Dying of full-blown AIDS in a prison hospital at 25. By the way, he robbed that gas station with a metallic blue water pistol that he won in Seaside Heights after he knocked down a few milk bottles at one of the stands on the boardwalk. He painted it black to look like a real gun. He was a tough kid in high school, too. Nobody fucked with him. He went from that to being somebody's girlfriend in prison. He used to call our one friend crying, telling him what was going on. I can't think of anything anyone could possibly say to comfort someone in that situation. I like to remind myself of this when I catch myself complaining too much while going about my business. This might come as a surprise, but sometimes I complain. Sometimes I get up from an afternoon nap in my beautiful apartment, look out at my view of Manhattan, and realize that I have to drive to a gig in traffic so that I can say ridiculous things into a microphone and get paid for it. I'll leave for that gig knowing that I usually receive between 30 and 50 grand for my efforts, and still, I'll complain about the traffic. If there happens to be traffic on the way home, I'll complain about it then, too. I don't know about you, but sitting in all that traffic gets me depressed, even with a check for 30 to 50 grand in my pocket. Some days, when I wake from my nap, knowing about the traffic I'll sit in, I find it hard to even get in the shower. It is one hell of a cross to bear. What snaps me out of it is knowing how I'd feel if I'd missed my train. I'd be waking up every day in Rahway State Prison instead of my apartment, knowing full well that there would be no traffic delays when my prison boyfriend decided to fuck me. The best scenario that I'd hope for every morning is that he'd fuck my asshole. When you're a prison girlfriend, you don't get to choose where your boyfriend fucks you. Best case, your asshole. Worst case, your mouth. Actually, the worst case is if he fucks both, and God help you if he fucks your asshole first. I'm getting lost in the details here. My point is that some version of this would be my life every single day. How about that for an alternate reality? It certainly would have brought a sense of structure to my life, which my high school guidance counselor told me I lacked, though I don't think this is the type of structure he had in mind. So in prison, in my 20s, I'd at least know what every day had in store for me. The only change I could expect in this version of my life would come if my boyfriend tired of me and decided to trade me for a pack of Newports. That would be an exciting time of transition. Until my new boyfriend decided how he'd fuck me every day. That was my friend's life. And it could have been mine. Risk is a fascinating thing. It's seductive and necessary. It can bring you everything or take all that you've got. We all take risks, the only difference being the degree. If my mother didn't take a chance on me, my life wouldn't have been very funny. I'd still be a wise ass, of course, but I'd also have a gaping ass. Instead of living in a penthouse, I'd live in a cell. Instead of a girlfriend with big tits, I'd have a boyfriend with big tits. Instead of sending my hot girlfriend out for a pack of cigarettes, I'd get sold as a girlfriend for a pack of cigarettes. Instead of never seeing or hearing my girlfriend's shit, I'd do nothing but see and hear my boyfriend's shit. Instead of having a girlfriend who was about 25 in my life, I'd be someone's girlfriend for about 25 to life. Chapter 5. the bad cop. One of my oldest living friends is a guy named Dan McGrath, who fans of the Stern Show know as the bad cop. Since we're talking about risks and luck, probability and possibility, and betting with both your money and your life, we have to talk about Danny. This guy has been a world-class risk-taker since I first met him. He also happens to be someone who hasn't won most of his life's bigger bets. Actually, now that I think about it, he hasn't won any of his life's bigger bets, and that has made all the difference. I did a stand-up gig in late 2015 at the Stress Factory in New Brunswick, New Jersey, and Danny came to see me. He was seated in the front row, which I didn't realize until I got on stage. It threw me off because I tell comedy club owners never to put somebody from my guest list anywhere near the front where I can see them. It's not because I don't appreciate them being there or because I don't think they deserve a good seat. It's because I find their presence distracting if I'm made aware of it. Dan was on my guest list, of course, because he couldn't afford a ticket. And he looked so awful because he abuses drugs and doesn't bathe that the owner figured that his name had to be a mistake. He didn't think that Dan could possibly be one of my guests, so he decided to seat this strange, homeless-looking guy in the front to give me someone to goof on. Before I continue, I need to give you some background on Dan so that you fully appreciate this story. Dan has struggled with drugs for most of his life, which is something I also know a lot about. But unlike me, Dan never found financial security, so he's had no way to support himself, let alone cover up the damage his habit has done to him. For example, a few years ago, Dan literally had about 5 or 6 teeth left in his mouth because the rest had rotted and fallen out. Never take oral hygiene for granted because you can die from neglecting your teeth to that degree by poisoning your own blood. Dan's mouth was in such a sorry state that I did what any good friend would do and paid for him to see a dentist and get a new set of teeth. He was very excited about this, and frankly, so was I. Finally, I could buy him a meal in public without him scaring the appetite out of everyone else in the restaurant. He called it chewing solid food again. I called it progress. The very next day, I called Danny at work to see how he liked having teeth. His boss told me that he never showed up that morning, which surprised me, so I started calling his cell phone. He didn't pick up, so I left messages. "Oh, hi, Dan. I see you didn't go to work today. What are you doing, walking around smiling?" That was one. "Dan, it's Artie. Hey, are you out there in the world eating frozen Kit Kats, walking around like a big shot?" That was another. "Hey, Dan. Artie again. I hear you didn't go to work and you're not picking up, so I'm guessing that you're too busy doing all the things in life for which teeth are required." "Dan, it's Artie. Your boss called me. He told me you went out bobbing for apples. I bet you caught more than last time." I didn't hear from Dan for 3 days. I'll let you fill in the blanks about what he was doing. Need a hint? It rhymes with whack. When I took the stage at the Stress Factory that night in 2015, I saw Danny right away because he's hard to miss. And on the spot, I ditched the bit I intended to open with and told the following story about him instead. He and I both graduated Union High School in 1985, but didn't see each other much over the summer. I had no idea what Dan had planned for the fall, but I wondered because, after all, I didn't have any plans myself. I finally ran into him on a Sunday night in the first week of September in the game room at Union County College, which is where my friends and I used to go to try to hustle people at pool. We'd shoot 9-ball and try to make beer money off drunk college kids and whoever else would play us. From what I gathered, when Dan wasn't going to high school parties, hustling pool in the game room and the pool halls around town was what he'd done with his summer. He talked about it seriously, as if it were his summer job. Neither of us had harbored ambitions of getting into an Ivy League institution, but believe it or not, I recall the two of us tossing around the idea of going to a state or county school while standing around a keg at a party senior year. Union County College, where we liked playing pool, was a very viable option for us. Back then, it cost about $400 a semester if you were a resident of the county and had a pulse. "Danny, what are you doing this fall?" I asked him. "Are you going to school here at county?"
"I'm either going to county or I'm taking the cop exam," he said, lining up his next shot.
"The cop exam? Do you want to be a cop?"
"No, not really."
"But you're thinking of taking the test?"
"Yeah, I'll take the test if I don't enroll in college."
I was very confused. "Dan, fall semester starts next week, doesn't it?" I asked. "There is a deadline for enrolling in classes."
"Yeah, I know."
"So, how do you not know if you're going or not?" I said, and I laughed a little bit. "I mean, it's just around the corner. Wouldn't you know by now?"
"Listen, man," he said, walking the length of the table, full of confidence. "If the Giants cover tonight, I'm going to Union County."
He looked at me a minute before lining up his shot.
"That's all I know."
I could tell he wasn't kidding, but I didn't know how he could be serious. "Dan, wait a minute," I said. "What are you talking about? I'm as big a fan as you are, man, but what do the Giants have to do with your college career?"
"Here's the deal, Art. My parents gave me enough money for the first semester, and they told me to register here. I told them I registered, but I haven't done it yet because I'm not sure I want to go. So I bet all the money on the Giants game tonight. If they cover, I go to school, and I go in style. If they don't cover, I don't go to school. The decision will be made for me, and I'll take the cop exam."
I'm not kidding. This really happened. One of my best friends put his future in the hands of the New York Giants, which, as much as I love them, is a dicey proposition even in their good years. "Dan, if you're serious, which I think you are," I said, "let's get out of here and watch the fucking game, man. It's about to start." I called all our friends from a sports bar nearby and told them to meet us because for the next 3 hours, we were going to watch Dan McGrath's future unfold. A few showed up, but most of them thought I was pulling their chain. The next 3 hours were exciting. But, to put it lightly, it wasn't the best night for Big Blue. I shared this story with the crowd at the Stress Factory that night in 2015, never revealing that Dan was in the room right there in the front row. Some time had passed since I'd bought Dan his new teeth, and it was as clear to me, even from the stage, that he hadn't followed the brushing and flossing regimen recommended by his dentist. Those pearly whites, his second pair, had gone brown and begun to fall out. He looked like a toothless hobo, worse than ever, with dark concentric circles all the way around his eyes. He was also painfully thin, like an Olsen twin on a hunger strike. I kept glancing at him while I told the story, but never long enough to make it obvious that I was talking about him. I tried to watch his reaction in my peripheral vision because the story was killing. Who wouldn't laugh at a guy who gambled his future on an early season Giants game? I let the laughs peter out, which took at least a full minute and a half. "Everybody, guess what?" I said. "Dan, that same Dan, is here tonight." Laughs immediately, and a few people say, "No! Yes, he is. He's here, I swear to God. He's in his very room, and I am not kidding." I paused. I looked at them. "I'm going to introduce you. Stand up, Dan," I said, pointing at him. Dan stood up, slowly. "Here he is. Don't be shy, Dan. Turn around. Let everyone get a good look at you." Dan kind of smiled, which was gruesome, then turned around. "So, guys," I said, "what do you think? Did the Giants cover?" I love this story because it is as strong a cautionary tale as I've ever heard. The moral of it is as clear and obvious as a fairy tale. Danny literally gambled with his life. He bet all his potential and possibilities and left it up to chance. And he lost. Dan wasn't even an NFL stat aficionado, so it's safe to say that he made a knee-jerk bet, and that decision changed the course of his life. You might think that losing your shot at a college education over a Giants game would be a sign to change your ways, or at least question your instincts,
not to Dan. He's what I like to call a pure-hearted gambler, the kind who loves the chase and never learns. He didn't change at all. He did, however, take the cop exam and went on to an infamous career in law enforcement until he was dishonorably discharged 10 years later. He and his girlfriend even got mixed up with some coke dealers, and when her father found out, he went right to Danny's superiors, and that was the end of the line for him. Danny had broken the law, but he didn't do time because nothing he'd done was that bad in the bigger scheme of things. Cops know that if a cop goes to jail, it's basically a death sentence. You've got a cement fortress full of criminals, and the new blood is a cop. Gee, I wonder what's gonna happen. In Dan's case, he'd put a lot of dealers away, so he had plenty of enemies on the inside. If you ask me, a cop heading to jail should be given a revolver and one bullet so he can do the right thing because he won't last a single night in the big house. Thank God they made Danny a civilian again, put him on probation, and let him go without pension or a recommendation of any kind. It was merciful, but in every other respect, he was completely fucked. Good luck getting a job after you're dishonorably discharged from the police force. Nobody will hire you. Basically, you end up begging for dishwashing shifts at Macaroni Grill. I lived in Los Angeles for 6 years, from 1995 to 2001, which is when Danny's life took a swan dive into the gutter, so I witnessed this tragedy from afar. When I left, he was a cop, he was in great shape, and he'd always been good-looking, so factor in the uniform, and it's safe to say that he was doing well with the broads. Danny always got lots of pussy when we were growing up, so as a cop, he was a rock star. He was making cop money, which isn't great by any means, but when you're 23, it's enough to have a fucking ball. Last I saw him before I moved, he was living with this really hot Filipino chick whose father was a doctor. She had money and a nice condo, and life was looking good for Dan. When I spoke to him on the phone, he made it seem like everything was cool, even though it sounded to me like he was having more fun than cops were supposed to. Cops are no angels, but I could tell he was taking it too far. But who was I to judge? There I was on the other side of the country, drinking too much Jack Daniels and doing too much blow and undermining my career in TV by constantly pushing the boundaries. If you're listening to this and don't know anything of my inglorious past, I'll keep it short and sweet by saying that once I got what I always wanted, which was a paying career in show business, I fucked it all up. I was a cast member on a sketch comedy show produced by the one and only Quincy Jones, and was really excelling there, which I responded to by putting it all at risk. And I went down in flames. At the end of a long coke bender that lasted several days, I ran off set, made a scene in a grocery store, and ended up punching a cop in the face, while still in possession of a huge bag of coke. I was arrested, charged, and immediately released from the show. If you haven't heard that cute little bedtime story before, you'll find it told in great detail in Too Fat to Fish. I still think what I did, and I punched a police officer, pales in comparison to Danny's self-sabotage. After blowing his shot at college on a Giants game, he became a coke-addled cop, and then upped the ante by becoming a runner for a bookie while still on the force. Now that I think of it, that's another reason I would have ended up as a pawn in an illegal gambling operation if I'd continued life as a longshoreman, because Danny was already doing it. A runner is a cut above a bagman, by the way. He's the bookie's messenger who takes bets and visits regulars every week. When you're a runner, you're trusted and a part of the machine. Even in our most corrupt states, however, a member of law enforcement cannot be a runner for a bookie. It's more legal and acceptable to sodomize your cousin. It would have been stupid enough if Danny did this when he was off duty, but he didn't. He did it while on duty as a cop. That meant he'd show up in his cop car, wearing his cop uniform, to collect bets or deliver money. He had turned his life into a Scorsese movie. When I would come home to visit my family during those 6 years, I'd place bets with Danny, as much as I couldn't fucking believe what he was doing. At the time, my mom lived about 50 miles away from where we grew up, but Danny drove down there anyway in his squad car, each time with a different rookie partner. That kid would be nervous as hell, even more so because Danny would keep telling him to shut up and not tell anybody. One time, we were in my mom's driveway when the cop radio in their cruiser went off. The dispatcher on the other end requested that all available cars respond immediately to an incident. Danny had no intention of doing that, and actually looked annoyed as he leaned over and shut the radio off. "Dan, what are you doing?" I asked him. "You've got to at least try to show up for that."
"Don't worry about it. They'll get it," he said.
"What do you mean, they'll get it?"
"This guy's closer than us. They'll get it."
"Yeah, but Dan, suppose that happened and you were the closest car. What then?"
"It wouldn't matter. They'd get it. There's enough of us to go around."
As funny as I thought it was, I could not believe what I was hearing. "Dan," I said, "listen to me. If Internal Affairs assigned a guy with severe Down syndrome to your case, you know what would happen?"
"What?"
"That guy would bust you." "Dan, the way you're behaving, a deaf, dumb, and blind Internal Affairs investigator could catch you. What the hell are you doing?"
"You've got it all wrong, Art. Everything is under control."
On the days that Dan did shifts as desk sergeant, he treated manning the front desk at the station as if he were working the phones in a bookie's back room somewhere in Staten Island. He would leave real calls, probably emergencies, on hold while he took bets from his boss's clients. And if you've ever seen a cop show, then you're probably aware that every single call that comes into a police station is recorded, because that's the law. That didn't bother Dan one bit because he'd thought of everything. One day when he was on a desk shift, he called me to shoot the shit, and as we were talking, he started to ask me if I wanted to place bets that week. "Dan, what's wrong with you? You're at work. I'm not putting in a bet on the cop phone," I said. Right after I said it, we heard a loud beep, which is what happens when you call the police. There is a beep every 10 seconds to remind you that you're being recorded.
I know, he said, "but don't worry about it. I've got a system."
Beep. "Are you serious, Dan? No, you don't. This is a cop phone and we're being recorded." Beep.
"I've got a system. Listen to me. A lot of teams are animals, like the lions and the dolphins, and everybody likes animals, right?"
Beep. "Sure, Dan. Everybody likes animals.
And there's nothing illegal about someone calling me at work to tell me that they want to go to the zoo to pet some animals."
"Dan, that's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard."
Beep. "No, hear me out," he said. "Say there's a week when you want to bet the lions. What you do is call me and tell me that you want to go to the zoo and pet the lions."
Beep.
"Then you tell me how many times you want to pet the lions."
"Wait a minute, Dan," I said. "Time out." Beep. "How about the teams that aren't animals, genius? Am I supposed to tell you that I want to go to the zoo to pet the 49ers? If I want to pet the Jets, do I tell you I want to go to the airport to pet the airplanes?"
Beep. "Very funny, asshole. No, that's not how it works. When I'm at the desk, you can't bet on teams that aren't animals."
Beep. Like I said, Danny had it all figured out. Anyway, you know how this story ends. But no matter how many times Dan fucks up, I'll always be there for him. He burned through his first set of teeth, and I'm sure he'll burn through the next set I buy him. But I'm not even mad. If you run into him at one of my shows or book signings, which will only happen in New Jersey, by the way, because Dan doesn't travel far, let me know what's left of that second set of choppers. Everyone deserves a second chance, especially when it comes to teeth. These days, I pay Dan's rent, too, which costs me $1,200 a month. I found this arrangement easier than watching him do the same song and dance for me every 30 days, year in and year out. I just put him on my payroll, so now he picks up his rent from my business manager on the first of the month and leaves me alone. I'm happy to do it, because he'd be on the street otherwise. No one else he knows can afford to support him, so I do. because that's what best friends are for. Every once in a while, I wonder how Dan's life would have turned out if the Giants had covered. Would he have gone to college and graduated? Or would he have studied? Would he have ended up addicted to drugs and destroyed his life anyway? Probably. But I believe that being a cop sent him deeper into drugs because he witnessed horrors that no one is equipped to deal with. He covered a pretty rough neighborhood rife with drugs and crime and told me stories that I could barely process. It was the kind of place where, more than once, he and his partner found the remains of an infant that a junkie had killed by putting it in a microwave because it cried too much. He saw that more than once. There's no way to prepare yourself for that. When you're a cop, you become jaded or you go crazy. There's no other way to survive the job. Danny numbed himself out with drugs, alcohol, and strippers. He was always fucking strippers, which is a lot of fun for a night or two, but when it becomes a habit, it starts to erode your soul. I don't blame him at all, because I would have done the same thing. There was a strip club called Knockers, exactly one block from his precinct, for Christ's sake. I'm not kidding. It was really called Knockers. That is where he would have breakfast most mornings, after doing the midnight to 8 a.m. shift. Knockers opened early for the cops, and anyone else who wanted to see strippers first thing in the morning, which was very considerate. They even had a special they called something like Legs and Eggs, or maybe it was Tits and Grits. It was breakfast and boobs for the boys in blue. The owner of Knockers knew the score, because after a nice hot meal and a lap dance, any cop who went for breakfast at a strip club was going to look the other way when he saw girls giving blowjobs in the parking lot. Chapter 6 Engine Giver. This one kid I worked with at Port Newark hosted a poker night that was always a dealer's choice game. Four or five of us would go, real guys, and we'd play five-card draw, seven-card stud, real guy games. This was long before every jerk-off in the world started playing Texas Hold'em, trying to be as cool as James Bond in Casino Royale. You know how that happened? Ben Affleck played Texas Hold'em once for charity on Bravo's Celebrity Poker, and after that, every fag in the country wanted to be just like Ben. It's ridiculous how that game has become some rite of passage. It's now considered a test of your skill at cards, and it really shouldn't be. Straight poker has always been a better game than Texas Hold'em. Five-card draw, five-card stud, that's what real men play, because those games involve true gambling. Raising, not raising, bluffing your opponent. People say that about Texas Hold'em, but they're wrong. People who prefer Texas Hold'em can't handle the swings that are at the heart of real poker. Sure, the turns in Texas Hold'em are on the flip cards, so you can go from having the biggest fortune to nothing at all, which is enough to make it too dangerous for most people. That kind of swing from all to nothing thrills the true gambler, but it's also not as dangerous to them as it is to the average Hold'em player. A lot of people don't think there's skill involved in riding those waves, but there is because if you're a practiced gambler, you know how to read your opponents, so the swings don't surprise you. You plan for them. If you aren't able to constantly read your opponents while playing the game, you shouldn't be playing any type of poker at all. Stick to Go Fish or War. Did you know that they actually have tables where you can play War in Vegas? I know this because I caught a couple of the guys who worked on Howard's TV show playing it when we were out there. I waited for them to finish up and called them over and said, "Never do that again. What you did isn't immoral, but it is deeply embarrassing. If you can't help yourselves and you need to play War, never tell anyone about it." I can read people well enough to win card games, but winning that way doesn't thrill me. When I play cards, reading my opponents is never my primary strategy, not because it's not a good one, but because it's much less exciting than betting and playing the game. I'd rather try to manipulate the other players with bets or bluffs or other behavior. I'd rather just play and let chance do its thing than sit there on a stakeout all night. Some people are so proud of their ability to read people, however. Usually they'll mention it as some kind of warning, like they're doing you a favor. Usually I tell them, "That's good to know, man. Can you tell what I'm thinking right now? Here's a hint.
Fuck you.
Or I break out a joke I used to do in my act. For those who don't know, when you play cards, a tell is an involuntary gesture that gives players away when they've got a good hand. It can be an extra blink of the eye, or the twitch of a cheek. Players who go that route pride themselves on reading tells and having none. So I used to say, I love playing cards, but my tell always gives me away. When I get a great card, I violently shit my pants. The movie Rounders is the first movie Matt Damon did after Good Will Hunting, which is easy to forget because he did 5 movies in a row where he played a genius. Anyway, in that movie, John Malkovich plays a Russian gangster who has a tell that Malkovich later admitted was a goof he improvised. His accent in the movie had to be a goof, too, because he's such a good actor, but in Rounders, he sounds like Yakov Smirnoff playing a hitman. In the film, Malkovich's character is unbeatable because he has a tell no one in the underground gambling club can figure out. His character also likes to eat Oreo cookies while he plays. At the end of the movie, which is about 2 hours long, Matt Damon figures out what everyone else, conceivably for years, has missed. He realizes that the Malkovich character's tell is that he eats an Oreo cookie. Usually a guy scratches his nose or rubs his eye, but no, this Russian thug eats a cookie. And you should see him do it. He takes it apart, he eats the middle, he really takes his time with it. I can't think of a more obvious tell. It's the most ridiculous thing any card player has ever been asked to believe. Norm MacDonald used to do a joke about it, and in one deadpan punchline, he proved how bad that movie sucked.
Have you seen Rounders? The guy who eats Oreos while he plays eats an Oreo when he gets a good card. Now that's a tough table.
Anyway, this kid I worked with at the port hosted card games at his house in Downneck, and we weren't high rollers, but we all liked gambling, so the pots got pretty big. Back then, Downneck was protected, and still is, which means that no one fucks with people in Downneck. That neighborhood is justifiably featured quite a bit in The Sopranos, if you know what I'm trying to say. It's located close to what locals call the Pasta Triangle, comprised of Bloomfield, Belleville, and Nutley. Satriali's pork store is right around where I hung out, as are a lot of other Sopranos locations. That show is understandably hooked into those neighborhoods. They even mention the Chicken Savoy at the Belmont Tavern, which is a dish that celebrities, popes, and politicians have come from far and wide to enjoy since the 60s. It's delicious, by the way. Chicken on the bone, baked with herbs and cheese, and sprinkled with red vinegar. The last scene in The Sopranos took place at Halston's, which is an ice cream parlor in Bloomfield that I grew up going to because my cousin lived around the corner. I eat hot dogs and ice cream in the booth where Tony is last seen before the screen fades to black for the last time, leaving you unsure of whether he lives or dies. Despite the non-Italian name, Halston's is a very Italian place, so during that final scene, as I watched Tony and his family sitting there, I thought that if he were going to be whacked, it would be by someone who shouldn't be at Halston's. I was watching the finale with my cousin, and he agreed with my theory, so we started looking at everyone in the scene, every extra sitting in the background, everyone coming and going, watching for someone who was out of place. About halfway through, 4 black kids come through the door. "See anything that doesn't look right?" I asked. "Anything that looks odd?" We both started laughing, because in all the years we went there, there was never a black kid in Halston's. Not that they weren't allowed in, they just didn't come. It was an unspoken mutual agreement that we were pretty sure hadn't been amended. So that's Downneck and the Triangle for you. Let's get back to this card game. As I mentioned, it was a dealer's choice game, and when it came around to our host's turn to deal, he always called Injun poker. I want to be clear about this. He meant Injun as in Native American woo-woo Indian. The rest of us made fun of him for it because that is the gayest name for a card game, and it's a pretty ridiculous game. It's also very racist, but that's beside the point. Here's how you play. Everyone is dealt a card face down. Everyone puts that card up against their foreheads, facing out. That is apparently supposed to represent a feather, as if you're Native American.
See? I told you it's stupid. You can't see your own card. You can only see what everyone else in the game has. And then you start betting. You guess blindly while trying to figure out where you stack up. You have to look around, take stock of the cards on your opponent's heads, and